ladies and gentlemen. This is the latest episode of the Preach Jacobs podcast. I am Preach Jacobs. I am your host. We are sponsored by Coker Center for the Arts and Soul House. You can check us out at Soul House and Coker Center for the Arts on the third floor. We have an exhibit right there that is called Colicon, Hip Hop and Comics Relation. Really, really great photography. Really, really great artwork with Daniel Lish and a few other amazing comic book illustrators, including Sanford Green from Columbia, South Carolina, and many, 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 many more. We also have our next installment of the Soul House Sessions. This one is going to be with civil rights activist Cecil Williams. Make sure you go to CokerCenterForTheArts.org to get the tickets. It might be sold out by the time y'all hear this shit. I don't know. But if you don't go to that site, you can also go to all my social media stuff, Preach Jacobs, et cetera, et cetera. It's been a while since I did one of these episodes, but I've been really, really busy. So I will also say for you guys to keep your eyes open on my Substack, preachjacobs.substack.com. Primarily, I was doing a lot of column writing for local publications here in South Carolina. Shout out to the Free Times, the Post Courier, Columbia, and the state newspaper. But I feel compelled to, if I really want to write the stuff I really want to write about and talk about, I want to have my own platform and do the things that I think I need to be done. And this is from the advice of my late dear friend, Delana Dameron, that said, stop working with these motherfuckers, do this shit yourself. So, I'm really excited to have this guest here as I sip my coffee because my throat feels groggy. This young lady is...
Not so young.
So look at you whispering.
Well, because you're the main one talking.
All right. Fair enough. All right. Gina Green is a strategist, writer, movement builder, founder, and principal of Horizon Philanthropy, and partner and chief. Let me do it again.
I'm going to start all the way over. Oh, my God.
I said chief. Gina Green is a strategist, writer, movement builder, founder, and principal of Horizon Philanthropy, and partner and chief strategy officer at Uprise. She's been published in the Washington Post, LA Times, and more. And you can recently find her in Black and Jewish America, Interwoven History on PBS. If you're looking at the trailers, they got her on a reel doing all the hand talks. You talking with your hands, the rap hands.
Talk too much with my hands.
No, not enough. Not enough. Yes.
All right. Take that under advisement.
What's going on? How you doing?
I mean, as well as one can do under fascism.
Yeah. That sounds about right.
It's an absurd and wild time to be alive. Mm-hmm. And one day, sometimes 1 hour at a time. Mm-hmm. So I take it.
Well, I really wanted to talk to you specifically because I think that we're touching on kind of similar things. And I think you have the right perspective for these things. So I recently wrote something on my Substack talking about ICE and what was happening with Renee Good and Preddy and the murders that happened out there. And there was a while before I wrote something because I felt that just writing a column just felt extremely, extremely fucking underwhelming, right? It really feels like, you know, if you're involved in being an activist or using your art to speak out against things, sometimes we feel as if whatever we're doing is not enough. So I really kind of, and this is why I'm interested
because
in talking to Cecil.
Because we can't stop murders in the streets.
Yeah. Got it. You know, but I also feel like, you know, with all the stuff that's going on, you know, how does activism look for an individual that if a young person says, I want to get involved and just help them with the good fight, right? And a lot of times the argument is always, oh, just vote, or oh, just whatever. And I think that is such an incomplete approach to change because we're always being told that, hey, there's a political process. Hey, there's this and this and that. Well, there's no faith in it right now, right? So.
And there shouldn't be.
Absolutely.
In this moment, honestly.
So how would you... If a young person says, I want to be involved, I see all the stuff that's going on with this administration, aside from telling somebody to go out and vote, how do we inspire young activism with young people to look like and feel like there's change being made?
Whew. That's a really big question. I'm glad you're asking it today. I literally just had a panel conversation with my organization, Horizon Philanthropy, with a group of donor advisors, philanthropists, a staff person at the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Kate Mayer, who is the executive director of Be the One South Carolina, which actually works specifically on youth civic engagement. And I think what's really important to think about engagement is that civic engagement is not just voting. Mm-hmm. It isn't just doing those electoral things. It's not what I call discrete democracy. And what is needed now is the type of democracy that looks like what we saw in Minneapolis after Operation Metro Surge in the Twin Cities. What we saw there was intense, hyper-local organizing and activism around what I've called keeping people safe here and alive. Yeah. That is number one. That is priority number one of democracy right now, is keeping people safe here and alive. So the way to feel engaged and involved in your local community is get involved at the local level, at the block level, at the neighborhood level, because there are going to be people who are unsafe in your community who need your protection, who need your mutual aid, who need your support. And that is the way, that is what democracy looks like right now. Because the other democracy, the voting, the elections, the courts, all of those levers have been captured by the fascist regime. Yeah. They've been captured by the administration. And so we actually have to do other things in order to feel and exert our own agency.
So you were out in Minneapolis, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that experience.
It was just as bad as every dispatch that you saw. Neighborhoods were... I mean, people were being dragged from their homes, dragged from their cars. Wow. I happened to be staying with someone who, when I was in Minneapolis, a good friend of mine happens to work for state government. And she also happens to be very active in her local groups. And so her phone was going off constantly with official state business and official local save this family at the end of the block business. Mm-hmm. Can you come be here and observe the atrocities that ICE is doing? And so I was able to see that up close and personal. And the fear that Minneapolis and the Twin Cities and Minnesota was a test case and both an indication that, you know, the regime said that it was about fraud, remember? They were like, we need to go to fraud. And it's like, well, if it were about fraud, then where were the forensic accountants?
Absolutely.
Right? Like, if it were about fraud, y'all would have been looking at the books, not sending masked agents into the streets. So,
and they basically accepted the concept of fraud based on some high school YouTuber or something like that.
Exactly.
It was real journalism, no real investigative reporting that told them to come out here. And quite frankly, it just feels like more of a personal vendetta against Tim Walz.
Against Tim Walz and against states and places that do progressive things and that do things that help communities and people. Minnesota has been one of the most progressive states in the country. They've passed all manner of legislation around paid family medical leave, and around a number of items. And Minnesota also has a history of, quite frankly, they have a socialist history. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they have a strong union history. They have a strong hyper-local community love. That is what Minnesota looks like. And it's kind of like, you shouldn't have fucked with Minnesota first.
Exactly.
Right? Because Minnesota has now shown the world what it looks like to be the kind of place that they have actually always been, have always been, and has been activated more recently with activism over the last decades, most recently with the murder of George Floyd.
Yeah.
And the response that they did there.
And I feel like, you know, we saw in the news recently, we live in Columbia, South Carolina, for the two listeners of this podcast. Hi, Mom. Right?
Hi, Mommy. Hi, Daddy.
But he wants
I call them Grammy and Grampy, though. So. Really? No.
But I said that to say that, you know, there was this announcement that they're opening an ICE facility in Columbia, which is downtown Columbia, and I think the largest building downtown on Main Street. And it just kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. And all the local politicians, including our mayor, said, we knew nothing about this. It is a 10-year, several million dollar lease in the biggest property in downtown Columbia. I just find that hard to believe. So I'm wondering, as we have, you know, local and young people that are really, really anxious about something like that that's happening here. And unlike a Tim Walz, we have a McMaster.
Henry McMaster.
Right? Who has been a champion of Donald Trump, the first politician to like actively endorse Trump when no one was taking him seriously. You know, what do you see happening with this facility to come into Columbia? And do you think there's a way that public outcry by looking at what was happening in Minneapolis that we can activate in a way to kind of, you know, curb them coming here?
That is an excellent question.
Look at that. And two in a row.
And the answer is I don't know. I think that when fascist regimes take power, anything is possible. And the only thing that does beat them is organizing. And so can we get organized to the level? Are we organized to the level and capacity and strength that we could fight something like that back sufficiently? It seems really hard, to be honest with you. It seems really hard to be able to beat back ICE. I mean, they are a multi-billion dollar industry, which is just about, you know, the only agency that's guaranteed to be funded. Tons of money coming in, and that is their primary vehicle for their oppression right now. So we know that they're invested in it and they're dedicated to it. And this bit about the, you know, folks not knowing, who the hell knows if city officials didn't actually know, but we know somebody knew, even if it wasn't the mayor and the city council.
Well, and that's the thing that I say, right, is that I feel like
someone's complicit, even if it's not our lawmakers.
Well, this is where I'm going with it, because, you know, the mayor said he put out a whole, like, you know, Instagram post saying, I knew nothing about it. Any accusation of saying I knew about it is irresponsible. And my argument is this: I don't know if I feel better if you didn't know about it, right? You can say I didn't know about it, but I'm like, the fact that this is happening here and you don't know shit about it, if you're telling the truth, right? Either you're lying or it feels like incompetence, right?
Correct.
And I don't think that either one of those things are comforting. Right. Now, again, like, we're talking about McMaster. I'm sure he knew about it.
I mean, it could have been, Lord, I could speculate till the cows come home. But I do believe someone knew. Who knew and to what extent, we may never know.
And I'm reading this quote. I put this in an article that I wrote speaking about ICE. Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote something for Vanity Fair recently. This is a quote from it. He says, Trump has clarified an inconvenient fact: the culture war is an actual war. ICE of the homeland enjoys an $85 billion budget, a sum larger than the annual military budget of every country in the world except the United States and China. So ICE basically has more money than actual militaries for entire countries.
Because they are the agent of the oppression and the harm. They are going to be the vehicle. They will be the administrators of the concentration camps. They're going to be setting up as detention centers that when, like, they will be the ones.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I feel like, you know, what happens with younger people is that we feel like when we see a lot of shit, I'm not saying me as a young person. I'm sorry.
You take that shit back. I mean, I'm happy to take back some youth.
Well, but, you know. Hey, listen, this is an audio podcast. They can feel the side eye you just gave me. But when I'm hearing younger people talk about this, there's always this ideal that when they see shit like this happening, they feel like that this has never happened before. And I always have this saying, I'm like, when in doubt, ask a black elder, which is why I'm interviewing Cecil Williams, who's 88 years old, right? And so when there's questions of, you know, this despair, when there's questions of feeling like, you know, we're not getting anywhere, I'm like, let me speak to somebody that's gone through this, right? And so when we're talking about what's happening with ICE in the streets, I'm like, hey, you know, this is history repeating itself. Like, I wrote an article saying this feels like the United States of Jim Crow, where the way we look at, You can impose like the black and white footage from the 1960s, the civil rights movement. Look at what's happening in Minneapolis. It looks like the same thing.
Just in color.
Yeah, just in color. And we're looking at World War II. And you know, if we look at concentration camps, the Holocaust, we also celebrated the anniversary of when Japanese Americans
were interned here.
So a lot of these things are similar and they're happening. What do you, at a glance at this, seeing this stuff going on, what do you think is going to be the thing that has to change?
You're going to have to narrow that question down. The thing has to change where and when.
A better question for you, right? And I'm glad you said that, because I'm giving you all these vague questions, because I'm trying to give you the canvas to paint with. I'm thinking from the perspective of...
Well, give me a few colors to choose right? from about that.
I would say probably within the next couple of years. Like, what does this look like? Like, does this look like if Trump is completely out by 28, which is these doubts that he's going to try to leave willingly, right?
Right.
And let's say we get a left president, Democrat president. Do they just have to go in and it has to be... An overhaul of everything? Do we say, hey man, ICE is a failed concept? Hey FBI, we're gonna charge Cash Patel and all you motherfuckers for redacting all this stuff. You know, we don't have to kind of just completely just overhaul all this stuff? Or do you think that it's just too far gone?
Well, what's clear is that our democracy always needed an overhaul.
Absolutely.
That what we have arguably has been one of the best democracies the world has ever seen, and has still not been good enough for many of us. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's that. Some of us thought it needed an overhaul 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. So there's that. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there has been a lot of damage that has been done by the regime, both in Trump 1.0, you know, pre-damage was done then, giving us a preview as to what might happen if he were reelected. And there's going to have to be a lot of repair. At the end of this and during this, there are going to be a lot of Americans who have suffered harm as a result of this regime. And just like I said, there's sort of two pieces of democracy work right now, keeping people safe here and alive, and actually continuing to do that democratic work of the courts, of protecting elections, of running candidates, because we can't cede the traditional work either. Well, both of those have to continue to be done in the world to come. That said, I'm open to what the future looks like. What is clear to me, and this, I mentioned the panel that I had with folks earlier this week on democracy. One of the things that one of our panelists was talking about in regard to this time period is that the window, the window of saving enough of our democracy to be able to do that is closing.
Wow.
There will come a time, and we probably won't know that we've gotten there until after we've passed it, that democracy as we know it will be irrevocable. So that is why all of the organizing, all of the work, all of what we see happening in local cities and jurisdictions across the country has to happen.
Yeah.
It has to happen, because that window is closing, and it will be too late at some point.
Well, I have two questions as far as that's concerned. But the first part about that, when we're talking about democracy, first things first, is I saw that Britain arrested
Andrew Mountbatten.
Yes. Right. Which, by the
former
way,
former prince, yes.
By the way, they stripped him of these titles about a year or so ago. So there's a lot of this we see this happening. And then I think the same day was this a former president of South Korea is going to life in prison for trying to stage a coup. And you're seeing how these other countries are holding these higher ups and these figures that seem that might have seen or felt untouchable being held accountable. Do we see, or do you see, that when all this shit is said and done, does Trump pay for any of this shit in a legal matter? Is there going to be, because the argument was Trump was running for president a second time so he can stay out of jail, right? Do we see justice coming in that regard? Do you have any faith that that's going to happen at all?
No. I think that there may be some degree of accountability for the perpetrators of the violence against girls and women that were documented in the Epstein files, I think that that will happen to some of those folks by nature of cancellation, boycott, avoidance. You know, I think that some of those folks will end up paying a little bit of a Me Too price, if you will. I hope so, for sure. I think that Trump is above the law.
Wow.
And I think that the election proved it. Elections 1 and election 1.0 and 2.0 both actually proved that he is indeed above the law. And I don't expect him to pay any sort of legal price.
Well, so here's my question. So, like, if we're expecting him not to be able to run again, right? That's the whole disclaimer, because he could be like, I'm emperor, right?
Right.
Let's say we get a Democrat in the White House. Do you think this is going to be a President Ford situation where he's basically like, hey, I absolve Richard Nixon from everything. You know, I pardon him. Like, do you... like?
I fucking hope not.
But that's what I'm saying. In my mind, if there is a huge shift, if we flip all these seats and we have these, like, other elections that's coming up and Republicans looking terrible, you know, they tried to kick... this Democratic guy from Texas, I forgot his last name, off the Colbert Show. Like,
Tallarico.
There you go. There's a huge shift that's happening. So if things are leaning in a way of there being this regime shift, in order for Trump, and I would also say his DOJ, I would also say his FBI, all these people that are complicit with this Epstein cover up, in order for there not to be, I guess, any accountability, would mean that Democrats didn't do anything when they got in power. So do you see Democrats saying, you know what, we don't want to stress things out, let's just, you know, blah, 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 quietly kind of fall back? Or do you really think that there will be an attempt to try to hold these people accountable, even if we feel like this shit can't happen?
I hope that there will be an attempt. I think it will be really difficult to achieve. And we certainly, just like I was saying, we can't cede all of those levers of the democracy that are not actually available to us anymore because of the regime, such as the courts and other aspects. That because of that, we can pursue the accountability. I don't think it will be gotten. And that is definitely the tough part here. I think about... in this moment, who can and will be held? And like, who gets to do... let me back up.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about the elections, and you were just saying, if we get this, if we get that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really big ifs in this moment. Because to your point, you know, Trump's talking about dictatorship, being an emperor.
Mm-hmm.
That's just about him. But... there are thousands of local elections across the country that are controlled by Republican trifecta-controlled state legislatures and in states. And those elections, it is not outside the realm of possibility that there will be some election shenanigination happening in places. And... yeah. That to me means it's a big if we get that. Now, here's the thing. I think Zohran Mamdani has shown a path forward for Democrats in terms of winning elections. And I think that a progressive move is the way to go and has been the way to go for a long time for the Democrats. So I think that if elections are free and fair, we do win.
Yeah.
We do win. If elections are free and fair,
yes,
we do get the House back.
Yeah.
We, you know, that I believe that will happen. I'm just not certain that they will be. But I was actually in conversation with someone associated with an election administrator in the state of Virginia, and she was telling me that their office always gets asked by regular everyday people who feel like they don't have any agency right now. Mm-hmm. What do we do? What do I do? What can I do? And they say, go be a poll worker. Go be a poll worker. Now, here's the thing. I agree with that, except that I think this is going to be the most dangerous elections we've had in decades.
There's these conversations about ICE showing up at the polls.
Exactly. So I'm not telling Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks to go be poll workers. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I'm not telling everybody that, because I think that some of us, I don't think I know, some of us are at more risk in those situations. But being a poll worker, keeping your eye on the activities of your local precincts and jurisdictions in an era where free and fair elections are absolutely potentially under threat and in jeopardy is a good way to be active locally.
So do you see, there was an article I read, it was just like, there was a quote, I forgot how it went, but it was just like, leave it to the Democrats to snatch victory.
Snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Right.
And Gamecock fans know how to do that too.
And I feel like, you know, there is an opportunity of younger people getting involved. And, you know, New York has a 35-year-old mayor. Is he 34? Yes. Right?
Like, and he's 34. Yeah.
I think that's incredible, you know, where the party would be scared of the AOCs of the world, where I'm like, maybe they should push energy towards a lot of these younger people.
The AOCs, the Jasmine Crockett's, the Zohra Mamdani's, these are the leaders of not just the party, but the future.
Absolutely. Oh boy, don't let me get started with you brought up Crockett. At some point, I wanted to talk about Stephen A. Smith, but I want to get I don't want to touch none of that shit right now. It's a whole other conversation. But the second part of what we were talking about with democracy, and this is kind of fueling my personal push towards, you know, writing more on my own as opposed to going through, you know, the column work that I was doing for these local publications, is because I feel like when you're looking at, you know, what happened with Washington Post, where and I wrote about this too. This has been really fucking frustrating. And this is the question that I had about this, where it's like, you know, Bezos just fired 300 people from the Washington Post, yep. something like that.
Yep.
You know, 60 Minutes is completely feel like it's compromised because of the CBS situation and this lawsuit that was afraid of and this merger that's happening. And there was a producer that left 60 Minutes recently that was there for 30 years. Now Anderson Cooper is leaving 60 Minutes. There's this lack of faith with these giants of journalism, the places that we looked at and respected and loved.
Right.
And so there's a part of me that's thinking, do you think that this now marks the era of independent journalism kind of taking the baton and running out there? What do you see with the public losing faith in these the Washington Post got their bones with all the president's men.
With the deep, deep reporting.
Right. And now that's compromised. And what pisses me off the most about Jeff Bezos about this is that when we talk about billionaires, there's always this concept of fuck you money, right? Where it's just like, hey, I have so much money that if I don't want to do something, I don't want to do it. But yet he's spending 70 something million dollars to get the rights to produce a Melania documentary.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So if you have fuck you money, but you still do it, that means you want to do it.
Correct.
Right?
Well, we knew that. I mean, I think everyone knew that when Bezos bought the Post, he wasn't doing it to practice good journalism. That was not the purpose and the end of his acquisition of the Post. So there's that. And journalism was already up against the wall, too, in terms of funding itself and its funding mechanism going out the door with, you know, print advertising being dead. And so journalism was already in a rough spot. And independent journalism was already picking up the pieces of the mainstream. That said, I think there's trends all over indicating that independent journalism, just like folks who were able to direct market products to people because of TikTok Instagram, people are able to do that with their news. And it is good that people are able to get and access other sorts of content, media, and journalism. And I feel some sadness, I think, that there is no longer one or two single addresses for all Americans. Like, there isn't a we don't all get most of our news from the same place.
Yeah.
It is so rare that all Americans are experiencing a same thing the way that used to be true.
Yeah.
A lot. And when there's no common denominator, and in an era of AI where we cannot, an AI of disinformation and misinformation, if you marry so much bad content and bad information out there with unfettered access, it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
People can access tremendous information from scholars and thinkers and folks like you that they couldn't access if they didn't get the free times or what have you before. But we can also access information that is harmful, incorrect, and designed to divide.
Yeah.
And so that feels difficult to navigate and a key piece of a future going challenge to me.
I think one of the things, and shout out to David Remnick, who said this in a podcast recently. And I say that because you can find her on an episode.
Sitting across from the David Remnick, correct. Yeah. Yes.
Now, I think he's a fascinating writer. I'm a huge Ali fan, as you can see about this painting in here. He has like one of the great Ali biographies. But he said something that I just thought was hilarious. Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million. He has a yacht that's $500 million.
Right? Oh my gosh.
Right? Yeah. So the question of, and this is where I ask you for this, right? You know, he can say, I have to do these layoffs because it's not profitable and there's a money situation, yada, yada. But I will argue that when he got in the way of the editorial department, when they were wanting to endorse Kamala Harris, you know, they lost 100,000 subscriptions, right?
Correct.
So when you're looking at talking about it not being profitable, at what point when we're talking about like the news sources, I've been watching a bunch of shit about the moon landing again. I've been like obsessed with it. And all the stuff that we've seen from the 60s or so, you see Cronkite after Kennedy's assassinated. You see these voices for the moon landing or all this other things that's happening. You know, these companies didn't treat the news division as a part that needed to be profitable, right? It was a community service.
Correct.
Right.
The sitcoms paid for the news.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was, and they were separated. It was like, hey, you're not gonna hold me to these same standards that I gotta make sure that we have enough advertising for this. But all that shit has shifted. So it's just like, if the richest man or second richest man in the world can't have a news outlet and say, hey man, this is a community service based thing, in a weird way, is that philanthropy if he looked at it that way?
Mm.
You know, if he can't see it that way, I just don't understand, you know, what's going to happen with these platforms in the future, because it's scary, because he owns that. There's a billionaire that owns the LA Times. There's Elon Musk owns Twitter, which is another, like, I would say a news outlet.
Absolutely.
Right?
At this point, yeah.
And I think the New York Times is owned by like a small family, right?
Mm-hmm. That
they're not these huge billionaires, right? And New York Times has always sounded like this place where you can kind of trust their reporting and their journalism. Like,
they're not broke though. Let's
Well, they're not broke at all. But I would say that do we have any fear that, like, you know, is that the goal, is for there to not be any trust in these major publications?
Absolutely. I mean, the media being captured is a key piece of any fascist regime, is being able to control the media and control what your people have access to. Now, that is what makes the internet and this digital age, that capture becomes potentially less important in fascism 2026 United States of America when there is an internet and so many other vehicles for the distribution of information. However, like I was saying, the amount of slop, dis, and misinformation out there competing with legitimate, well-researched reporting and information is tough. And unfortunately, after decades of underfunding public education, we now have an electorate, a population that actually I don't think many of us are skilled in critical thinking and cannot detect the difference between the mis and disinformation. Mm-hmm. And that isn't any shade on anybody, except to say, because the mis and disinformation is good.
Yeah.
The AI is good. Yeah. And it can fool you. And that is absolutely a part of any regime's plan to oppress the people.
Oh, well, I think that's terrifying.
I mean, yes, it is. It is absolutely terrifying.
Well, I guess there's always this idea of when you see, like, these thinkers or these community leaders when they're writing about stuff. I remember Ta-Nehisi Coates was on one of these shows, and he was on Colbert, and Colbert basically asked him in a way it felt as if Colbert was looking for Coates to kind of like comfort him.
He was asking the wrong person.
Yeah, this is where I'm going. And he was just like, well, you know, do you have any hopes for such and such and blah, 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 blah? Because, you know, you look at the Baldwins and the Coates and the Morrisons of the world, and they're so great with their perspective. They're so great, you know. And Coates is like, no. Like, that's not my job, though. My job isn't to give you optimism. My job is to tell you what the fuck is going on. And I could kind of see Colbert's face kind of like crumpling a bit. I'm going to try to find that interview. But I will say, as someone like you that is heavily involved with these things, where does the, I don't want to use the word hope though. Like where does the optimism come from? Like what do you see happening, with the other side of the fight that's combating this bullshit?
Yeah.
What part of that do you feel is making positive traction?
I am energized by the way across the country, in local communities and jurisdictions, folks have figured out how to win progressive power. That has happened across the country. Districts have flipped from red to blue. We actually do have a way forward. We do know the way to win elections, and we do have those lessons that have been learned across the country. That makes me feel good, because that to me means that we have the beginnings and the tools and some of the pieces of what we need to build what's next. Now, I don't think I mentioned earlier that the window to hold on to what we've got enough to keep the descent from being absolute despair,
mm-hmm.
into an absence of democracy, and we have to also be able to, you know, I just lost my train of thought, Preach.
I'm sorry,
this
my
is,
bad.
No, hold on. No, it's perimenopause. That's what I'm blaming it on. What was I saying? Hold on. We were talking, you were asking about the hope.
Yeah.
Yes, the hope. So we know what to do.
Mm.
We know what can win. And what has happened now is our ability to do and our ability to win has been eroded by bad actors, has been eroded by the regime. But we know what we can do, and we have that vision. And there are people across the country who've been thinking about it, who've been doing it locally. That gives me hope. Am I going to get to experience it? That depends on whether or not we're able to do what we need to do before the window of opportunity closes.
You keep thinking that window is open. If it's like the slimmest of cracks, a little bit of air is getting in with a breeze outside. Real quick.
Yes.
Who do you see is going to be the Democrat nominee for president?
Oh, gosh.
Not one person. You can give me some people in running that you see. And this isn't necessarily an endorsement, but this is
right.
You saying that I see something happening with this. And I guess everybody's going to say Gavin Newsom, but what do
you
think?
Yeah, I think you can't not say Gavin Newsom. I feel like you can't not say Mayor Pete's going to try. I'd like to see AOC run and get in the game. But it is anyone's guess. I don't think that there is a leading front runner. And for me in this moment, partially because, like I said, I would love to see AOC run.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the party, and I know a lot of people disagree, I think that the party should move left and should move progressive and should deviate and depart from the sort of big money pro-corporate politics that have captured both parties.
Yeah.
Till now.
Okay. Well, anything else you want to say to our adoring listeners?
Adoring listeners? Thanks for listening. Preach, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
Anytime. Have you back. We have to talk about Stephen A. Smith, right? Aren't we? Like, we have to...
No, that's going to be off mic, because, like...
You can if you want to,
because it's... I've been... All right, you started. No, I'm really terrified about what's happening, because I feel like, all right, I have this theory. When we're talking about the shift, because Trump 2.0 presidency is different than 1.1 or 1.0 to me. I think the shift came with January 6th, and I'm going to tell you why I think the shift came. I think that was the most powerful thing that happened with Trump, because if you're a young white man that not quite on Trump's side, but you're kind of like teetering here or whatever, the most powerful thing that happened, the most powerful thing that happened with that young white man is like, yo, Trump had motherfuckers ready to
storm the right,
ready to kill and die on his behalf, and to a fool, they think that that's real power, and they're basically like, even if I don't believe or agree with this, I want to be associated with somebody that can compel that type of energy. So it inspired in a very, very harmful way. Here's what I say about Stephen A. Smith and Trump. Trump is basically a celebrity that ran for president.
Yes.
And people can argue about, oh, Ronald Reagan was an actor, but Ronald Reagan, before he was president, he was a governor for a long time,
California,
right?
Correct,
right. So, right. So he got involved in community service or being involved, out there, no matter how terrible he was, but he got involved before he became president. And so this idea of Stephen A. saying, "Oh shit, I can be a celebrity and run for this," I think is such a harmful trend for us to entertain these people to run for real public offices just because they're fucking entertainers, right? And when you think about it, you know, if you...
Just because they have enough visibility to win.
Exactly. Because the visibility is half of it.
Absolutely.
It's one thing if you're a celebrity because you have a history of community service, right? If you're famous because you're out there helping out the community or whatever, right? Like, I would argue, rest in peace to Jesse Jackson. Maybe we should touch on him too. I'd rather touch on him than Stephen A. Smith. But, you know, Jesse Jackson, when he ran in 84 and 88, he had a history of being a civil rights leader. So by the 80s, he was probably seen as a celebrity, but he was a celebrity because he did community service.
And had been in it for a minute,
absolutely,
right?
Like, right.
Had been, right.
Absolutely. So Stephen A. Smith, whose whole entire career has been debating about sports, and this is one of the things, and I will see what you think about this, he always has smoke for black women.
Yes, he does.
Right? And one of his arguments about Jasmine Crockett was criticizing her tone. And I'm like, Stephen A. Smith, whose nickname is Screaming Stephen.
Of all people.
Yeah, right. So I feel like, so he's talking about, oh, you know.
Well, we can't win, first of all, a lot of times. Let's just like say that.
Yeah. And also I think that one of the things that Stephen A. has gotten completely wrong is he said in an interview about a couple of weeks ago, he said if he think he can win. If he ran for president, he's like, I feel like I could win, right? Which, delusional or
some
not.
Some level of delusion is necessary.
Delusional or not, I think what's going to happen with him is what happened with Trump. And I saw this specifically in South Carolina, because when Trump began his campaigning, it was in 2015, he would come to South Carolina. And there's a photographer from here that I know that when Trump would do these rallies, there would be like four people there. Nobody would show up to these places in Charleston. He would take these pictures. And then Trump would say all the craziest shit. And so when he would say crazy stuff, you know, the left media, just as much as the right media, would report it. Now, whether the left media is reporting it to make fun of it, you know, the reality was somebody that doesn't understand that, all they know is that they see his name in the press.
Right.
They see his name in the papers and in the press more than anybody else. So they assume, oh, there's smoke, there's fire. He must be the better candidate. And I saw that level of celebrity and that level of visibility translate to these people with, he must be more qualified, right? Stephen A. is on television I don't know how many hours a day. Then he ended up getting a political show on Sirius FM, having like this whole concept of let's hear both sides of the argument shit has been it kills me. As soon as you start defending people,
you can only do that with certain sides. Not all sides get to be on both.
Exactly. And I feel like I'm really scared about it, because he's like, yeah, I'm thinking about doing it. I think he's really serious, and I think it can do real harm. But I'll also say that if he thinks, because he said he's going to run as a Democrat, if he thinks that he's going to get any kind of Democratic nomination without the support of Black women, he's highly mistaken.
I mean, would he win? That's tough, because I think what Biden showed, and with transferring, you know, with pulling out of the race and handing the reins over to Kamala in June of you know, the election year, I feel like the establishment, he doesn't need the support of Black women to get the nomination, to get that support. Mm. Because the Democratic establishment and the insiders who kept Biden in, and mm-hmm. you know, those folks are still going to control the nominating process. And so do we get to play in those? Do Black women get to be in where some of us are there? But let's be clear that the decisions around who gets to be the Democratic nominee are not made in the voting booth.
Yes. I think you're right about that. I'm just really, really scared, and I'm just anti-celebrities.
Well, here's what's tough. So I'm glad that you said anti-celebrities, mm-hmm. because what I think about is anybody should be able to run for office. Mm-hmm. There's only an age requirement for the presidency, right? Anybody, and that is what we the people is actually supposed to mean. And yes, if you can get enough of the people on board with your ideas, then you should win. I think Stephen A. Smith has silly ideas, and so I doubt that he would be able to get enough people on board. I mean, I don't think so. I just don't think so. But does he have the charisma of a Trump to be able to command that type of support independent of solid policy positions and public service track record? Does he have enough of that cult of personality to do that in this moment in time in such a polarized society? I think there's a lot stacked against an actual run of his, potentially. But there's a lot stacked against anybody who wants to run.
Well, right now. I really feel like at the end of the day, it can operate as a way to just take away enough Black votes from the real candidates, just to kind of create this... just for there to be kind of like this failure for the left. I also feel like, you know, when Trump got elected, then you start hearing people like The Rock saying, "I might run for president," mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. and I just feel like if you have no history of being involved with politics or community service, like, just don't touch it. You can find ways to be socially active, politically active, be an activist, figure out other ways to do it. But I feel like, you know, when people are doing this, is that the ego stroke that you want? You know, if you don't think you can win, like, okay, well, then why are you running? And some people run knowing they can't win something, but they want to create visibility for certain stuff. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I've seen that before, and I get that, you know. But I don't know. The Steve A. Smith shit just really, really drives me crazy. And I think that the more I listen to him, he claims he's a Democrat. He claims he's an independent. He sounds like a conservative, or I would say, and this is the argument that I have. I think that,
or at least of the corporate class, because I do think that. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I feel like I don't like calling people Republicans or conservatives anymore, because my argument is, if you were a Republican a decade ago, or 15 years ago,
you can't possibly be comfortable with what is considered the Republican Party right now.
This is something totally different.
Right.
This is and based on their definition of what being a Republican was, of not having the government overreach. Now, you know what I'm saying? Like, so by your own definition, this isn't what you signed up for.
Correct.
Right. And so I feel different when I look at it that way. And I don't know. And I don't know who's going to come in and change that. I just wrote something. I'll send it to you today where it was me kind of tongue in cheek with writing a letter to Tim Scott where, you know, when Trump put the eight faces on the Obamas, Tim Scott was like, that's the most racist thing I've seen come out of this White House. And I laughed And I laughed at that because I was just like, ha, ha, ha. And then I thought about it. And I laughed because I was more surprised he made a comment than I was seeing the racist shit.
Than what he said.
Right. But but then I said, oh, most. He said, this is the most racist shit you've seen come out of the White House. That's an acknowledgement that, oh, you... And so I'm like, okay.
And not only, but an acknowledgement, let's be clear, an acknowledgement that there has been racist shit that has come out, but that you think that's the most?
Exactly.
Well, a fucking video meme or whatever is the most?
Yes. Now his, I think his rationale is flawed, but I do feel like, all right, the fact that you said this, and he is he the only Black Republican senator?
Only Black Republican senator, yeah.
You know, I felt like, man, this guy, you know, I call it secondhand embarrassment, right? Because I feel like, you know, when he did that whole shit, when Trump was running again, and he's like, I just love you, and he's smiling. Like, it felt so uncomfortable. But the way that I wrote the article, I was so frustrated because I'm like, you're a Black man from Charleston. And I would imagine that we have more shared experiences of being Black people growing up in the South than differences, right? So I'm like, if you're acknowledging that this is racist, then my argument is, dude, when you were a Republican, became a senator, you know, when Nikki Haley put you in there years ago, this isn't what you signed up for. So I think when we're talking about flipping...
But people often sign up for power, not policies.
Ooh.
So, you know, there's that.
That's a bar.
It's true.
All right, I think we end on that one. I can't top that shit. Oh, my God. Okay. Thank you for coming. We definitely do this again because I could talk to you for like 5 hours.
For real. But we should make this a regular installation.
I mean...
Tell Preach if I should be on regularly.
I mean, honestly, like, I've been wanting to do... All right, we'll talk off mic because this is something I've been wanting to do for a while. So, and this is why I've kind of haven't done these episodes in a while. But we'll talk. We'll talk off mic.
We'll talk off mic.
Thank you guys for listening to the Preach Jacobs podcast. Once again, get your tickets for the Cecil Williams talk that we're having for the Soul House session. It's going to be February 27th, which means I got to get this episode out quickly. So I'm going to have a great talk at the Culver Center. Go to culvercenterforthearts.org, or you can also go to all of my social medias, all Preach Jacobs. Also, we have ColaCon coming back. Check out the interview that I had with Sanford Green. I think we're going to put this as an audio podcast as well, but we also have a video interview of talking about ColaCon. Please try to give out a GoFundMe. We're going to have all that information in the link in the bio for this episode of the podcast. More to come. Keep up with us, and also subscribe to the Substack, preachjacobs.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, but we also ask for some money because, you know, if I'm starting to leave these publications as paying me peanuts, I kind of want to make that money back. But you can still read and just support and spread the word. Thank you guys so much for listening to the Preach Jacobs podcast. Until next time, peace.
The preceding podcast is solely owned by its host or hosts and is distributed by Big Media LLC. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved.